looking now at the society, how society perceives agriculture. On one side, you see people in the cities somehow very much detached from agriculture and where their products are coming from. And on the other side, you find a lot of people who are kind of experts or highly interested in agriculture and where the products are coming from. So there is a ambiguity regarding the level of understanding and how farming in itself is perceived.
We can see a drastically different landscape when we look at East Europe, like Russia or Ukraine, where you have these big agro holdings. You can at the same time look at Europe, where farm size is more or less around the average 100 hectares or so. In the US, again, you have bigger farm size, or in Latin America. And I think that really makes a difference on what you can do.
So everybody has a kind of a role to play in the whole food supply. So there are individual farmer decisions on one side, but at the same time, a global food chain that need to be connected, which basically makes the whole process of farming not an individual topic, but actually every time much more complex, I would say.
Welcome to The World of Farming, the KWS podcast. Here we discuss topics that move agriculture with experts from a wide range of fields. In today's episode, Home Idyll or Global Competition, How International is Agriculture? We look at how agriculture works in different parts of the world and what the connecting elements are. I am delighted to welcome two great guests today with a broad range of experience in the international agricultural sector. Jose Bustos studied agronomy and business management in Chile. He then worked in various management and strategy functions for, among others, BBC Technologies from New Zealand and Syngenta in Switzerland. In 2017, he joined KWS, where he is currently responsible for the sugar beet business unit. Alongside Jose is Nicolas Villant. After studying agricultural economics, Nicolas Villant worked for various companies in the agricultural sector in South America and the US before joining KWS in 2006. There he was responsible for, among other things, the company's business in Chile and for various crop segments. Today he is head of the Corn and Sunflower Europe business unit at KWS. A very warm welcome to all our listeners. My name is Emma-Damian Grint, and I am the host of today's episode. So, huge farmland in Australia, challenging soils in the Eurasian Black Belt, like Russia, for example, highly specialised technology in the US. The production conditions for agriculture differ from country to country, while at the same time, farmers are increasingly involved in the global economic system. In Europe, we set certain standards for agricultural production processes, shaped by our lifestyle and our political agendas. But in other regions from which we source our products, different framework conditions may apply. What does this mean for farmers and consumers worldwide? What does farming in different regions of the world look like? We will now discuss these questions. So, Nicolas, Jose, how does agriculture work today within the different parts of the world? What are the factors that shape an agricultural system? I'm thinking climate, economy, political framework, for example.
I think if we start from the side of the location of where the farm is, you can highlight the soil fertility and the weather conditions. So those are proper circumstances that the farmer need to face. And then on the other side are all the human elements that basically regulate how the agriculture is conducted. And then you have from land regulations, also particularities concerning the farm structure, the cost of the land availability, which is also partially defined by the productivity of the land. There are elements also connected to the proximity of the farm to the market. So those would be frames which are given to the farmer depending on human factors, let's say. But those two elements, the conditions of the soil and the farm where the farm is, plus the human frame is basically, for me, the main key elements. I don't know, how do you see it, Jose, from your side?
No, I totally agree. And I think on the other side, as part of the human element, you have the cultural heritage, you know, because in a certain place, even if you could grow a certain crop, they don't do because it hasn't been traditionally grown there. And this tradition really shapes the landscape and the culture of a certain town or of a certain region.
It's really interesting. So what is the difference between agriculture in, say, Europe, America and Asia? And where do you think these differences come from?
Well, A simple one would be farm size. Now we can see a drastically different landscape when we look at East Europe, like Russia or Ukraine, where you have these big agro holdings. You can at the same time look at Europe, where farm size is more or less around the average 100 hectares or so. In the US, again, you have bigger farm size, or in Latin America. And I think that, that really makes a difference on what you can do and what are the practices that you can carry out. This also shapes the technology, the way the crops are grown, the way the technology is developed. You can see tractors and so on are completely different than these bigger farm countries that they are here in Europe. They're more technified, or the intensity, again, of the agriculture that you can do in these big farms, that they are more extensive, let's say, whereas in smaller farms, they need to be more intensive.
Mm-hmm. I would add maybe from my side, what has been caught my attention is how the land actually is passed from generations to generations. You will see similar patterns, for example, in the US or in Germany, when the family is keeping the land among them, and they try to continue that through the years. If they want to decide to continue in agriculture, then they need to seek to increase the farm size in order to keep it profitable. Then you go to China, where there is actually not private ownership on land, but actually there are pieces of land are assigned to small households for the production. And then you, as you were mentioning, Jose, you go to Russia and Ukraine. If you look at the case of Russia, after the fall of the Soviet Union, many privates have a hold on huge pieces of land, and today they're fully integrated. So you see sugar factories, which are also growing their own crop, and this is a total different way of understanding agriculture from a family to a large enterprise. And those are huge differences that we see today, basically from region to region.
And just following on from that, so what are some of the global challenges and trends that you see happening, and what are some of the regional peculiarities? Nicholas, maybe over to you.
I think there is one that is evident, and this is all in the media now, which is the climate change, and particularly the stability of weather through the season. So we are going from very extreme conditions, so very dry on one side, then a very heavy rain with floodings, heat waves during flowering, for example, heavy winds. This for the farmers, this is something that is really changing the conditions without providing them stability on their main business. So everything is less predictable. We also suffer from it as a seed producers, because we need to produce our seed, and we see basically this has been one of our biggest challenges in the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. At the same time, looking now at the society, how society perceives agriculture, on one side you see people in the cities somehow very much detached from agriculture and where their products are coming from. And on the other side, you find a lot of people who are kind of experts or highly interested in agriculture and where the products are coming from. So there is a ambiguity regarding the level of understanding and how farming in itself is perceived. And this is also not new, but as you see it in other areas, of course, fake news or social media might picture farmers sometimes in a negative light and not showing the importance they have in the whole context of food supply.
I would say another underlying change that we see, and this is really global, is the demographic change. We hear it a lot about the demographic change or the aging of the populations in the developed countries. But if you look at farming specifically as a subgroup, they are traditionally today held or managed by an older generation that is moving on. And the younger generation has a very different stance to agriculture. So either they don't want to participate in agriculture anymore, they want to live in the big cities and so on, and as Nicolas mentioned, be a bit more detached. Or they want, if they want to do it, they want to approach agriculture in a different way, maybe more professional, maybe with use of more technology and so on. And this will really change the way we do agriculture. Some of these farms that are inherited are then maybe rented out to more professional farming outfits or companies that have the investment and so on to develop those lands and so on.
So we've sort of touched on a lot of the differences and what farmers are coming up against, but what do farmers worldwide have in common? What are some of the similarities?
I think one of the key elements is that they all have the adventure to work in an open air with all the challenges that brings, basically. On one side, it's a very rewarding activity. You could say, I think farmers are generally enjoying the light and being outside. At the same time, as I said before, the appreciation from the society is not always there. But I think one key element is that they all count on their soil, so their ground is really the basis for their business. Therefore, to have a sustainable management of their farms is crucial in order to secure the long-term perspective. And especially when we look at family-owned farms, you will find a very sustainable approach to their land because they wanted to keep it through generation, while maybe in a big corporation or when soils have been rented, for example, then there would be a more short-term driven approach, which might derive in different practices, let's say.
Okay.
Yeah, from my point of view, farmers have in common that they are really optimistic. This is how I see it. I see farmers really ready to test things, but they need to test them in their own farm. They need to see it and touch it and feel it. Many times we try to sell innovation and they say, this happened 100 kilometers away from you and it's a great experience. They would say, let's test it here. Let's test it on my farm. And I think this is very common. They are really looking into technology with open eyes. For example, in my father's farm, we would always try and see what we could bring in terms of irrigation or sensing. We tried to get things online. This was years ago, and sometimes farmers have this image of being a little bit behind the curve, but I would say as it becomes available, farmers are really quick to adopt technology.
How globally does a farmer have to think today in order to be successful? Conversely, how regional must he or she think too? Nicholas, maybe over to you.
Right. So I think in general, there is the global demand on commodities is setting the price and farmers need to live with those trends. Then there's some regulations, for example, subsidies or trade tariff that will affect basically how those prices or those conditions are translated into their local market. And then from my perspective, the whole farming in itself have become in a very multiple decision-making process, so very, very complex. And I give one example in China, basically where small farmers are very far from the market where their produce or vegetables will be sold. There is a lot of intransparency. So somebody's coming to buy their products and they don't know at which price they will be sold. So they might give it up far too low of what the market is paying on the spot at the moment. On the other side, they might say, okay, the price this year was great. So next year, everybody in the village will grow the same. And of course, price will collapse. So there is a distance and lack of transparency, which today, luckily, the farmers through new technologies, for example, applications that will show them, okay, this is the spot market on a certain product, can help them to make better decisions. But this is definitely one of the challenges they have, is that basically the whole decision-making process for farmers have become very, very complex. And you see also that the different regions take different positions. For example, China on one side is a large producer, but also a large importer of crops. They do crops for food consumption like rice, cereals, and vegetables. But now they're also trying to produce global commodities like corn, soy, etc. for feeding animals. Brazil, on the other side, is a large exporter of agricultural commodities. So everybody has a kind of a role to play in the whole food supply. So there are individual farmer decisions on one side, but at the same time, a global food chain that need to be connected, which basically makes the whole process of farming not an individual topic, but actually every time much more complex, I would say.
So they're making regional decisions, but that feeds into a global landscape that they also have to fit into or play their part within.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
So as these big agricultural companies that we mentioned before, so the suppliers of the Nestle's or of the big food companies, they have a much bigger global view. They can see how commodities go up and down. They can plan their resources better. When it comes to a smaller family-owned farm, they somehow get hit by these ups and downs and they need to guess the market. However, as Nicolas was mentioned before, a family farm will have a more of a long-term view because they need to preserve their land in their family for generations, and therefore they would not do things that could jeopardize the health of their soils or at least try not to, whereas a company says, hey, this is the moment to go into corn or this is the moment to go into wheat, and they can go in a big way and disregard, in some cases, the sustainability or the long-term health of that farm.
It's really interesting. Thank you. So does this result in different requirements for seed or breeding processes, including services like personal advice, digital tools? Nicholas, I know you touched on that, but Jose, maybe you could.
I mean, for farmers, when deciding on crops, I think they need to consider all the things that we've discussed before. You know, what is their conditions and so on? What is available? What is the culture? What is the market that they can reach? But once they decide on a crop, that when it looks more into breeders and genetic suppliers, they need to find a reliable breeder that is dedicated to producing a product that will improve over time for the region. So I think that's quite important. And then if that company can provide them incremental improvements through better genetics, but also through services, will allow them to meet their goals. So I think that the breeders really need to have this local view to adapt to those local needs.
So how does a company like KWS respond to this? So I'm thinking, how do we know what makes our worldwide customers tick when there are all of these variations in the market, Nicholas?
So the first part, I think, for us is key to be very close to the farmers. So we have teams and we have subsidiaries around the world to understand really what are their needs. In order to be successful in order to make them basically tick, as you said, we need to show them proven results 2 years. So we need to be consistent. I think that's key for them. And this means, for example, that as the climate change, we need to adapt our portfolio in order to respond to those challenges. And this is basically the first mission we have as a breeder in order to basically provide the opportunity to adapt the crop to the conditions. And on the other side, we need to bring in a strategic technical advice to introduce new practices which will deliver value at their farm. And I give you an example. In the case of corn silage, it's not only about selling seed for corn. We actually, our aim is to try to optimize what kind of crops they need to grow in order to maximize their milk yield. So basically, we focus on the output, finally, what is important for the farmer, not necessarily on the crop in itself, but actually the whole cooperation and based on their farm.
I think that's a really good example. In sugar beet, for example, we've also been trying to focus not only on the climatic changes, but really what the regulation is doing, how we can replace chemistry that is being used for certain issues, such as herbicide control or fungicide control or fungal control, let's say. And we've developed traits that require less use of these chemicals, and that allows it to be more sustainable, but also at the same time easier for farmers to grow.
And for us, in general, the feedback from the farmer is key in order to adapt our breeding progress. And that's something we always need to look. We need that input in order to be able to progress, basically.
Yeah.
So there has to be almost like a multifaceted solution. Mm-hmm. So it can't just suddenly be, oh, well, here's a seed that suddenly produces more yield. But actually, we're looking at how do we reduce chemicals? How do we make it more sustainable? And how are we responding to the farmer? To understand what their needs are for now and in the future in order to be able to produce the seeds that are fit for the future.
Right, at the end is managing the farm in an holistic way and addressing all the elements that you have mentioned. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So it's really important to keep those touch points alive. We have different touch points, so we talk to the regulatory agencies of the different countries, we talk to the breeders associations, but also we talk to farmers on a daily basis about trying to sell them the seed, but also what's going on their farm. We have a longer discussion, and all this knowledge we try to funnel back into our breeding and R&D so that we can develop solutions. Somehow, with breeding, you have the challenge that it's a long way out. So you need to detect these things early or try to detect larger regions where you can see a trend moving in a certain way. So if we can see that, let's say, drought tolerance or the presence of drought is becoming more and more relevant in Europe, we can already say we should start as soon as possible to look for more low precipitation adapted crops or low precipitation adapted variants of our crops for farmers in those regions, because it will take years till we have a product that really does that.
Why do breeding processes have to be adapted to local requirements? And what role does the regulatory framework play in this? Especially when we talk about Europeans' demands on food production, for example, a certain ambivalence can be seen. Food should be produced cheaply and reliably, but also in a socially and ecologically responsible way. In Brazil, for example, the clearing of rainforest is heavily criticised, but at the same time, the country is an important exporter of various foodstuffs. Or if we are looking at the US, the use of herbicides and the cultivation of herbicide-tolerant plants is questioned, while on the other hand, the enormous burden of insects is evident. Does agricultural development depend primarily on the standards we use to measure it? Over to you, Nicholas.
I think the first part would be for me to see what is the overall issue. And I think we will need to be feeding an increasing population. Although that sounds already a bit cliche, but we see that the desertification of soils is advancing and together with poverty as well. I mean, we see migration issues which are connected to that. So from our perspective, we would believe in science as a contributor to respond to the challenges to deal with climate change and grow our population in a sustainable way. It's basically one tool. This would be the similar approach as we would rely now on science to find a vaccine or to provide new sources of energy. So for me, it would depend on what is the urgency to find a solution, how fast or not a technology will be accepted.
It's I think we're all kind of, especially in Europe, we're used to seeing stacked shelves in our local supermarkets. So the idea of food scarcity is not something that's relevant to our daily lives, right? So maybe that's part of the ideas that we have as shoppers in Europe, especially.
Yeah. And maybe one element which is key, we see now one of the new technologies for genome editing called CRISPR-Cas, which we are hoping that basically Europe will accept that as a traditional breeding tool in the future, because we see the possibilities. We have the scissors basically to make small changes in the DNA that potentially will happen spontaneously as well, but that will help us to speed up breeding and bring better adapted varieties in a much faster pace. Not doing that will set up Europe at the same time in a very competitive disadvantage with most of the other regions that very likely will move into this direction. The UK have already given some signs in that direction. Mm-hmm. We will see how basically the rest of Europe react, but we look very attentive and very hoping that this would be a positive development for us.
How do you see the prospects and development potentials of agriculture in America, Europe and Asia? In Europe, the Green Deal is currently taking shape. In the US, Joe Biden is making the issues of climate protection prominent again. Which path will other countries and continents take, Jose?
So let's, by starting with the EU, as Nicholas mentioned, we have a very different stance to some regulations. So EU is seen very conservative in that sense, but on the other hand, very forward in terms of sustainability with the farm-to-fork strategy, where we have an incentive for breeders and companies to move to replace chemical products, as we mentioned, or use less aggressive chemical products and increase the amount of organic production. So there's a strong push to more local production. And I think that requires a lot of support, and that comes in the shape of subsidies and so on, but it will be sustainable to a certain extent. So I raise the question mark, as Nicolas says, when does that work if we have this competitive disadvantage, if we see more and cheaper food being produced around Europe and not bringing that in, or what the regulation is going to be for the future, how sustainable that is. So that's a question. On the other side, if we look at China or Asia, for example, but mainly in China, they have a huge population that they want to feed. As we mentioned before, they are now adopting more some of the crops that we grow here in the Eastern world, so in the Western world, such as corn and so on. So they need to shape their own agricultural landscape to achieve food security. And it's still not clear what their strategy for GMO is going to be, for example. But I'm pretty sure it's going to be very different to what we here in the Western world can imagine. I mean, their approach to battling COVID by vaccinating the young people first to get them back to work was completely the opposite to what we did here in the Western world to vaccinate the elder population. So I think we will be surprised. They will have their own culture, their own way to approach it, and it will be a very big impact on the global agricultural landscape. And then if we go to look at America or Latin America, specifically, these markets rely a lot on agricultural exports, and I think they will look at their export markets and their regulation regulatory frameworks to adapt to them. So they need to serve other markets, not only their own. They have sometimes, by comparison, lower populations, but they produce a huge amount of food. So they look a lot into North America and the US specifically, but also to Europe, and they need to adapt that. So that's most likely going to stay, I would say, in that very much linked to foreign policy.
So interesting how different parts of the world are responding to these kind of agricultural challenges, but also the opportunities that are being provided by new technologies, as well as the demand for more sustainability and environmentally friendly practices, at least from some consumers around the world. Okay, so where are we going? Towards more international standards or stronger back to regional supply basics? Nicholas?
We would expect to see a more consistent approach towards production standards and decision based on sustainable goals. I think on one side, this would be driven by big food producers. So if you see Nestle, for example, or many other large food producers are demanding from the farmers or from their sources to meet certain sustainable practices. So I would expect that those sustainable approaches will be actually extended and will become standards. That would be the expectation. And the question whether it's a local or regional sourcing, for example, where transportation and the CO2 emissions play a role, I think it should fit within the overall sustainability position. So it's one part, but it should be a part of the equation, I would say. But for me, as food, as climate change lead to global issues as well, for example, migration, flooding, etc., as I mentioned earlier, we will expect that we will have a more consistent response and not actually individual decisions. That would be the expectation, let's say.
Yeah, but I think if we could split the crops somehow, if we look at the global commodities such as corn, wheat, maybe soybean, I think they will be traded, they are traded at a global scale, and they somehow will move the supply worldwide, and they won't be local. I think they will move around depending on regulation and price. But if we go to more specialty crops, vegetables or fruits, I think we will see more a shift towards local production and local consumption adapted to local needs. We see it already today, how much that's going to become relevant when people stop wanting to eat peaches in December here in the Northern Hemisphere and so on. But we see it's going into that direction.
And I think you mentioned an important element, how consumers also will shape and will demand certain practices as well. And basically there are new trends. I don't know, the example of peas, that based on the whole plant-based diet has been increasing significantly as a source of important protein. The main pea producer is in Canada, and due to drought and heat this year, I think they have about 45% of drop in yield, and this will create an issue on supply. So then coming back, would you be able to regionalize in order to secure your supply and actually to meet those consumer trends as well would be something that we will all have to have in mind, I would say.
Absolutely.
Okay, so this might be quite a broad brush question, but what is the impact of international trade agreements on agriculture?
So I think trade agreements, similar to regulation, really, really have a strong impact, because especially for export markets, so markets such in Europe where there is a bit, the production stays in the European Union at least, having this free exchange of goods between the European Union doesn't play a big role. But when we look at export markets, like as I mentioned, Latin America to Asia or Latin America to the US or from the US and Canada, as Nicolas was just mentioning about the peas, if those peas don't come here, there's no veggie burgers here. Or at least if the trade tariffs are too high to compete and so on, they will really change the way what you see in the supermarket is going to look like or the price it's going to have. So it plays a big role.
So there could be a lot of angry vegans out there come in 6 months' time.
But then this has a knock-on effect, and then the vegans who are probably also more aware of or at least having a stronger focus will say, I want my peas to be produced locally. I don't want to rely on this high CO2 transportation. And we will see that change how the growing environment will change here locally.
Mm-hmm. How is the demand for organic food developing globally?
I think that the trend is clear, and also that fits also to the farm to fork strategy that we see in Europe. So there is a significant increase, and there is also a commitment to increase the organic production in the future. Would that be a solution for everybody? Maybe likely not, also because of costs associated behind. But at the same time, I really rescue the value of showing a certain path that actually helped conventional agriculture to adapt some practices from the organic in order to reduce, for example, the use of plant protection products, to have a more sustainable approach to agriculture, and actually to prepare for the future where certain products are being, for example, banned. Okay, you know what? The organics have found a way of how to deal with a certain problem that we can immediately introduce. So I see it as a trend that actually is pushing the carriage in a certain direction, where we can welcome a lot of solutions that they find. Would that be a solution to fill the whole population? Maybe not, but would be also a fair choice for consumers? Definitely yes. So I would really see that we will see a continuous increase of organic as it is expected, but at the same time, looking at the organic with a very positive eyes on how we can learn from their production system into conventional agriculture as well.
And it's not realistic to think that suddenly we're going to replace conventional farming with organic farming. But it is realistic to believe that there will be an increase of organic farming, right? And like you say, that you're going to learn the lessons that maybe organic farming, organic breeding can bring into conventional farming as well.
Exactly.
And then you'll definitely see a stronger adoption again into the most specialty crops. So specialty crops will move faster in because they have a higher retail value. There's more value in that value chain that can actually pay for the sacrifices in yield or the different options that organic farming takes. But when it comes to extensive field crops, I think that market's going to take more time and probably is going to transition more into this, let's say, traditional but lighter way of doing agriculture in a bigger sense than it is with avocados and blueberries and so on. Yep.
Thank you. What agricultural structures do we need and want?
I think one of the key things we'll see in terms of structures is to be prepared for irrigation. I think we see that trend, and there are many parts of Europe, of course, where irrigation does not play a role, but there are many others where it does. And we see today, if we want to adapt to climate change, irrigation structure also being supported centrally from the different governments would be something that we would need from an agriculture perspective. The rest in terms of transportation, etc., infrastructure, those are more standard things. But from my perspective, looking at irrigation would be one of the key elements that we need to address in the future.
I think efficiency of water use and water or irrigation security is something that we really need to work on. Breakthroughs in energy technology that could lead to desalinification or desalination of water could allow certain regions to grow crops where there's no availability of no sweet water, for example. I think that would be a game changer and how that would look like. Another big infrastructure one that is really missing today, despite farmers being very prone to technology adoption, is connectivity. So many of these tools and things that are being developed rely on internet connectivity, and in rural areas this is not so good. Even in developed countries, having better connectivity could allow the use of sensing technology that could allow use of technology that requires less input, for example, by knowing where to apply what in terms of water, or in terms of chemicals, etc.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's been such an interesting discussion. Nicholas, Jose, thank you so much for all the insights and sharing your thoughts with us. Even though we could certainly go into more depth on many of the things that we've touched on, I think we've gained a very interesting overview of the various facets of global agriculture today. So that calls for a second episode, I think, between the three of us. But for now, thank you again.
Thanks a lot, Emma, for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Emma. It was great.
And that's it. That was The World of Farming, the KWS podcast. Do you like it? Then feel free to subscribe or recommend the podcast to others. Our podcast is available on all normal platforms like Spotify and Google Podcasts. Thank you.